Boyd. Up next on Think, public transit in America. Often it doesn't go where we want it or work when we need it. Whose fault is that? We'll spend this hour with journalist Aaron W. Gordon, whose recent reporting finds one major problem is the assumption that local transit systems should compete with their peers around the country for a share of federal funding and pay for themselves locally with the money raised from riders. Gordon says these policies starve rapid transit and give millions of Americans no choice but to spend money on a car. Our conversation starts after a short break. Love private industry in America, and our most efficient, innovative companies are the envy of the world. So we also love to ask public services to operate like private businesses, to pay for themselves with revenue from users. Transit systems are a good example of this. They can get some federal money for big expenses, adding new miles of light rail track or buying train cars or buses. But for day-to-day maintenance and operating expenses, they are largely on their own. Could this be why they don't work the way we need them to? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you live in a region that has some public transit but feel like you really have no choice but to own a personal vehicle, public transit does not work for you. My guest says our expectations about financial independence for these systems may be to blame. He thinks at this moment, when ridership has fallen to record lows around the country due to fears about spreading coronavirus, at this moment is precisely the time to do something about it. Aaron W. Gordon is senior writer for Motherboard. His article, Why the U.S. Sucks at Building Public Transit, is on the website Vice. Aaron, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
So cars are expensive, especially for people at the lower end of the wage scale. Why do so many of us feel like we have no choice but to own one?
Well, that's a big question. I think the short answer is, as you said, public transit just doesn't work for most people. It doesn't go where we need to go. It doesn't run as frequently as it should in order to be a convenient service. For most Americans who like to use public transit, they really have to plan their lives around the service that is offered rather than the service kind of conforming to their own lives. And that obviously isn't workable, for most people. So they need a car to get around and live the busy lives that our society expects from us.
One option some people have is to move away from city centers to find lower rents. But in that case, we end up sacrificing like hundreds of hours a year to our commutes, right?
Yeah, so I think in general, there's kind of choices that Americans have to make. And one choice is to live, kind of, as you say, pay higher rents in a city center where maybe they can live, without a car or at least not using a car very often and rely on public transit. Although I will say that in most U.S. cities, even if you live in kind of like a downtown core area, you're still going to be using your car very often. There's only maybe a half dozen U.S. cities where you can conceivably live a car-free lifestyle while still being kind of like a typical American worker. But as you say, that, if you then have to live outside of a city center, all bets are off. You're almost certainly going to require a car to live your life in a kind of normal way. And even though the rents are cheaper, nowadays cars are more expensive than ever. I think the average length for a car loan now is something like 70 months. Hmm. So you're going to be paying it off for a very long time. And, the month-to-month costs of owning a car, I think a lot of Americans kind of internalize them as a necessity. But if you happen to, live without one for a little bit, you kind of realize how much it is between the insurance, the gas, the car payments. You're talking hundreds of dollars every single month.
So as you note in the piece, we have understood in this country for decades that we ought to do a better job with public transit, but we haven't made all that much progress. How do we compare with other wealthy nations, say in Europe?
Well, compared to most countries that I think we've generally regarded as our international peers, Western Europe in particular, we are doing a very, very bad job of building and running public transit systems. I mean, you look at any European capital city, certainly, and even many regional cities, and they've expanded their systems tremendously over the past, I would say, two or three decades. London and Paris have both undertook major expansion projects, adding, you know, I think like between 75 and 150 miles of new service running right through the center of the city, or, you know, in the outlying suburbs. Moscow is building a huge expansion of their subway system. You know, I could just go on and on with what cities have done. Madrid, Lisbon, like all of them have tremendously expanded their service. And then you look stateside, and that just hasn't happened. You know, you can look at some cities, Dallas included, that in the last 30, 40 years have built, you know, I think Dallas has built something like 75 miles of light and commuter rail since the 1980s, which is certainly a high number. But you look at, you know, as I'm sure I don't have to tell your listeners, it doesn't go where most people need it to. It's not tremendously useful. Almost everyone still owns a car in the Dallas area and uses it to get around. And the Dallas area is just so much bigger than these European capitals that, you know, you just compare mile for mile. It just doesn't stack up, because in order to provide that same kind of usefulness to its citizens, Dallas's public transit would have to be so much larger than, say, London's and Paris's, which just cover a smaller area.
Well, and the irony is, therefore, you see a lot of light rail cars and a lot of buses passing you by, and they are not filled to capacity.
Exactly. And that creates a really negative feedback loop where, you know, when people drive by them, you know, or go by the stations, or, you know, if they ride it once for, you know, to go downtown for a game or whatever, and they see how empty it is and underutilized it is. And then the transit system says, or, you know, maybe some politicians say, we want to expand the system so that it will be more useful to more people and more people will use it. You know, people kind of understandably have the reaction of, well, but nobody uses it, so why would we sink more money into it? You know, it kind of has this feeling of a sunk cost at that point. I don't think that's the right way to look at it, but you can understand why someone would see it that way.
Something you explain in your reporting is that transit systems in America typically have two different budgets. What are those two budgets for?
Yeah, so I'll try and explain this in as non-nerdy way as possible. But basically, there's the budget to run the service day to day, week to week, month to month. It's called the operating budget. It's mostly comprised of labor costs, paying your workers. There's also, you know, basic day to day maintenance. A signal breaks, you got to fix it, that type of thing. And then there's the long term costs of keeping the system healthy on a decade-to-decade basis. And this is called the capital budget. That'll include things like buying new buses and trains. It'll include expanding the system to, you know, keep up with the demands of the urban area, and other major, what's called capital projects or major construction projects.
So cities and regions end up competing for a share of that capital money that comes from the federal government, right?
Yeah. So one of the, you know, you hear this breakdown, and I, at least when I first heard it, I thought, like, intuitively that makes sense, right? You want to have the budget to make sure you keep running your service, and then you want to have another budget for making sure the system is healthy on a longer term basis. But what ends up happening is this dichotomy is really broken down and becomes kind of a fictitious budget, especially the capital one in a lot of cities, where cities end up just kind of putting whatever they need in each respective budget to make the numbers work. And it ends up over time not bearing a lot of resemblance to reality. That's a big problem in New York, where I live, where the Regional Transit Authority, the Metropolitan Transit Authority, will, like, the capital budget, you ask them any questions about, like, how they arrived at the numbers or anything like that, and they just can't really answer them, because it's frankly fictitious in a lot of ways. It's just what they kind of think they might spend in the future. And so what ends up happening, you know, to get to your question is, you know, then when systems, you know, let's say Dallas wants to expand their light rail, they will ask the federal government for money to help them pay for it, because they can't pay for it all with local taxes. And the federal government will be getting these requests in from cities all over the country, but they only have about $2.3 billion a year to pay for all of these projects. And these projects are very expensive. $2.3 billion doesn't get you very far. And so they'll have to make decisions about who they give the money to. And they have their own set of criteria that they go through to make those decisions. And then at the end of every year, they say, okay, we think this project is worth doing. We don't think that project is worth doing. And that kind of determines what ends up being built in your local area.
So sometimes what cities and regions do is break up big projects over several years rather than competing for the whole sum at the outset, I guess, to make it more palatable to federal funders. How does that affect the pace at which transit expansions take place?
Yeah, that's a really key point, I think. So one of the complaints about U.S. transportation projects is they cost too much and they take too long to build. And of course, the two are closely related. The longer something takes to build, the more it's going to cost because you have to keep paying people, you know, over those extra years. And that ends up increasing the cost tremendously. Plus, they then get inflation that brings the cost higher, too. And so what the reason why this matters for transit funding, the way the federal government does it, is one of the criteria they look at when they're determining who gets money to build their projects and who doesn't is how much it's going to cost relative to the number of people that it expects the project to serve. And so naturally, you can't really change the number of people it's expected to serve. It's in your city, you know, the number of people, it's going to change that drastically. So then the thing that can change is the cost. And so let's say you're looking to build 10 miles of new rail. Well, that's going to cost a certain amount of money. But if we say we're only going to build 2.5 miles of that rail, all of a sudden it's going to cost a lot less, but still you can say it's going to serve about the same number of people. And because like the tail end of the track is probably going to serve fewer people because that's going to be more in the, you know, what tends to be less populated areas of the city. So you build the first segment that's closer to downtown first. And that's going to look a lot better on paper in terms of the cost to ridership served ratio. And so you end up breaking the project into segments. Now, this is something LA is doing with their Purple Line right now. They actually just got approval last month for their final segment. And what that means is instead of getting funding for the feds to build the whole 10 miles at once, they have to break it up. And that means there's a pause oftentimes between when you finish one phase and when you get approval to start the second. And the equipment doesn't stay in place. The laborers don't stay in place. You know, just like any project, you know, you're doing a home improvement project. Obviously, like, why would you stop at some arbitrary point, you know, when like the deck is finished rather than building, you know, the whole extension that you're building onto your house, right? That send the construction workers home, have them work on something different. All the tools go away. You apply for a new loan from the bank. Right, that we would kind of look at that on an individual basis, be like, that makes no sense. Why not just try and build it all at once? But that's exactly what happens with transit projects.
Are planners deliberately underestimating the cost of these big projects by the time they're finished?
Deliberately is a slippery term here. I don't want to accuse anybody of doing something untoward. It's not like fraud or anything like that. You know, I'm not accusing anyone of doing anything criminal by any stretch of the imagination. At the same time, these are fundamentally political projects. And political projects need approval from, you know, whether it's your local politicians who are, you know, clearing the way, whether it's federal ones. And anytime something costs more, it looks worse from a political perspective, generally speaking. So it's often to the advantage of the people who want the project built to try and propose it at as low of a cost as possible. And there's always been a tendency in this country dating back, you know, more than a century, where once you get that first shovel in the ground and the project starts going and you've already sold the community on all the benefits that this project will have, then if you try and stop the project, that it's not going to make sense to anyone, right? They're looking forward to the project. They've already committed to it. And there's kind of like this, you know, sunk cost fallacy element to it where it's like, oh, you know, what's another $100 million between friends on a $1 billion project or whatever. So there's this very ingrained sense that if you start to work on a project, if it costs more later, you'll find the money under the couch cushion then.
My guest is Aaron W. Gordon, a senior writer for Motherboard, whose article, Why the U.S. Sucks at Building Public Transit, appears on Vice. Chris Boyd speaking this hour with Motherboard senior writer Aaron W. Gordon, whose article, Why the U.S. Sucks at Building Public Transit, is available at Vice. So, Aaron, help me understand something. Fixing transit has broader implications for solving other problems, right? Climate change, pollution, traffic congestion. It seems as if any politician that made this happen would be the hero of the century. Why do we lack political will to get this done?
That's a billion, trillion, however many dollar question that I honestly, I still don't really understand it. I mean, I certainly have explanations to give you, but it still boggles my mind that no politician has made this their cause. I don't think many people like being in traffic all the time. I think people often like their cars in a kind of Stockholm syndrome kind of way. We become dependent on them, but it's very difficult to imagine a life in which we're not dependent on them in most places in the country. So I think to a lot of people, if a politician came around and said, I have a vision for a future where you will save maybe, let's say, $700 a month, you know, including car payments, by having a robust and useful public transit system, you'll get hours of your week back that you can spend with loved ones and family members and friends. Our cities will be less polluted, our skies will be clearer, and all of this can happen with just a few billion dollar investment per city per year. I think most people would just find that fundamentally unbelievable and would not buy into that vision. But that being said, it requires a lot of fundamental changes to how we view government's role in transportation. I think in the U.S., we have a mistaken belief, but a belief nonetheless, that cars are a private transportation system and public transportation is a government-provided service. And there's a lot of hostility in this country towards government-provided services. The falsehood here is that while you may own your car privately, it runs on roads, which are, of course, 100% government funded. Huh. In most places, I know there are toll roads now becoming a thing, which to me only increases the need for more robust public transportation. But that's another subject. So, yeah, to your question, I mean, I actually struggle to answer it because I think it's one of the many areas of policy areas in this country where politicians absolutely should be banging the table and making this one of their main platforms, but they don't because I think people just have a very hard time believing the benefits that could happen.
Was it ever realistic to believe privatized transit systems could thrive and serve every citizen who might need them? In other words, was it ever possible for them to be entirely self-sustaining based on rider fares?
That's one of the main myths about public transit that I actually had that as I was researching this article came to light. People believe, I think most people who don't, you know, aren't familiar with the subject, that public transportation either can or ought to pay for itself from rider fares. It ought to be run like any other business. And the fallacy is not only that that is not how it works currently, but that that's how it never worked. We have this belief that, I think even some people who know a little bit about public transit history think that, you know, because public transit used to be provided by private companies, that those companies were profitable, that they worked as standalone enterprises. But that's just not true. Either they were what we would call today public-private partnerships, where they got money from the government indirectly to help subsidize construction or operations, or they were part of some larger conglomerate. Streetcar networks were either owned by the electric company as a way to kind of like dump, you know, excess electric capacity during the day in a very cheap manner rather than just kind of like letting it disappear. Or they were run by real estate companies that, you know, wanted to build these gigantic new developments, you know, in what was the suburbs of their day, but they needed a way to connect them to downtown job centers before the automobile was really widespread. And the answer was to build their own streetcar network. And these systems ran at a loss as a standalone entities. And it was only until, you know, for various reasons, they were no longer the bills came due essentially. And the private companies dumped these services at a time when, you know, millions of Americans relied on them, that the government started running these services. And this was in mid-century when a lot of, when it was very common for politicians and many people in general to believe that there was a way to run these services better and therefore profitably. But the last, I would say, 50 to 70 years has shown us that that just isn't true. There's just no way to run these services in a profitable manner while still keeping fares affordable for most people.
I want to switch gears here for just a minute and talk about how COVID-19 is affecting public transit around the country. We've heard reports of employees in New York and some other cities dying of the disease, possibly having been infected on the job running buses and trains. You say we should be expanding train cars and buses running right now rather than cutting capacity. Why is that?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of when I wrote that, and I'm actually struggling remembering how long ago it was, because time is just a very difficult concept at the moment.
Yeah,
everything seems to be changing so frequently. But when I wrote that, it was at a time when public officials and the MTA here in New York and in other cities were saying, like, you can still use public transit, just try and, you know, practice good social distancing while on it. And that's not really the case anymore. Now there are public service campaigns where they're explicitly telling people don't take public transit unless you need to for your essential work or to get somewhere essential. But that being said, the basic concept of why I said that still holds true. These systems should be running as much service as they possibly can, because the best way to avoid getting infected yourself or infecting other people if you're asymptomatic and you don't know it is to maintain the social distancing, the 6 feet apart. And very basically, the more trains you run, the less crowded they're going to be and the easier it will be to maintain that social distancing. If you run fewer trains or buses and therefore provide fewer service, then the same number of people are going to have to be on fewer vehicles, which means they're going to be more crowded and it's going to be harder to maintain that distance.
All right, I want to go to the phones now. Our number is 800-933-5372. Tim is on the line in Richardson, Texas. Hi, Tim. Tim, are you with us? All right, I think Tim had a question about some public transit systems across the country not charging riders at the moment during the pandemic and others still charging. Are you aware of that? It's a development that I haven't heard about.
Yes, I have heard of that. I actually can't recall off the top of my head which ones aren't charging, but I know that some transit systems have dropped their fares. Others have changed the boarding procedures for buses, where if you used to have to board in the front door right next to the driver, they're now letting people board through the back door so that the driver isn't exposed to every single person who comes on and off the bus. So I think the reasoning behind dropping fares now is not to try and entice people to take public transit, but rather to reduce the number of contacts that public transit employees or that public transit riders have to make with one another. Typically, if you pay a fare, everyone is doing it at the same turnstile or at the same point of the bus. So this just reduces one more congregation point. And as far as revenue is concerned, these transit systems are they're losing so much revenue already anyways, that having riders not pay, the few riders that are still taking the service not pay, is not changing any fundamental math about what's going on. They're all losing, 60 to 90% of their revenue at this point, that a few extra percentage points isn't going to change anything.
I think you mentioned that you live in New York. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm curious about what that's like in a city that is so dependent on public transit. In Texas, where a lot of us have cars, we've been encouraged to sort of grocery shop as seldom as possible, sort of stock up and then stay home for a couple of weeks. Is that possible when you're carrying everything in your arms and maybe you can't get on public transit, so it's just as far as you can walk with your things?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I talk to relatives who don't, live in cities about this, and they say, "Yeah, I go to the store once a week, and I stuff the car, and then go home." And I kind of laugh, and it's like, "Yeah, we can't do that." I mean, some people have carts that they fill up, the little, I think they're called
like
grandma carts.
Yeah,
exactly. But we don't have one of those. I think it's very, if you live in a city, you are used to going to the grocery store to buy a couple of items every day or so, rather than loading up for the week. And I think people are trying to change that habit a little bit, but as you kind of said, there's only so much we can do to change that because we're limited by what we can carry. And so I think that, there's always been a kind of attitude in New York that you just kind of do the best with what you have, as limited as that may be. We're all kind of hunkered down in our, relatively small apartments by national standards. And I think to a lot of people who don't live here, they might find that concept intolerable, but to us, it's just kind of part of life here. I guess the not having the public transit aspect in general, I think, is a huge change to a lot of people's routines. Obviously, we rely on our subway and buses here. Very few people drive to work or commute. And I think, even though we talk a lot about how much we hate the subway or can't stand it, it's just like a source of common gripe. I've heard a lot of people kind of express almost a longing for the days where you got back on the subway again and it was crowded and there were lots of people there because it meant the city was healthy. And not just its people, but the city as a whole. And I think right now there's just a lot of angst that, you walk down the street, you go to the subway station that's normally crowded and it's completely empty. It's discomforting. And I think we kind of long that return to normalcy, even if we didn't appreciate it at the time.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, on the other side of the coin, how does the urban sprawl in much of the rest of America complicate the creation of effective and broadly accessible public transit?
In a very basic way, it just makes it harder to build effective public transit because fewer people live within, a square mile area, for example. Obviously density is public transit's best friend. The more people who live near a subway stop or a light rail stop or a bus stop, the more useful it will be to the people around there. If few people live near it, then you're running a service for the few people who live near it. And obviously that makes it much harder to work. And on top of that, if you look, at cities like Dallas and Phoenix, and to some extent Los Angeles, these cities that have really been built up in the last 50 to 80 years, then you're looking at cities that were built during a time when America was not building public transit. So these cities did not expand, or these cities did not have public transit expanding along with the cities. It had highways and roads expanding along with the cities. So now for cities that are looking for ways to create useful public transit, they're facing an even harder task than some of these older Northeast cities are, where they are having to build a new transit system onto land that has already mostly been settled and sprawled upon, which makes the task even harder.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Jim calling from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Yeah, I think you just pretty much answered my question. I'm originally from Chicago, and being up there, they have the CTA and the buses, everything that go for miles in every direction to the far, ends of the suburbs. And I was wondering why more cities the size of Chicago haven't done that. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think so. Chicago is one of those older American cities, along with, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, that actually do have pretty good bones for a good public transit system. One of the little things that I came across that didn't make the article is that there's so much unused railroad track in the U.S., decommissioned railroads that are literally just sitting there. And a lot of it could actually be quite useful to commuters and city dwellers. Here in Brooklyn and Queens, we have miles of unused track that run through areas that have been developed in the last couple of years. And it's just sitting there. And only now is the MTA kind of looking at ways to reuse it again. But to answer the question, the reason why a lot of newer cities don't have that is because at the time that they were expanding, the general impression from most politicians and even urban planners and transportation professionals around, this is around early to mid-century, was that the car was the future, build everything for cars, and there's no reason to muck about with trains anymore because everyone's going to own their own car and get everywhere by their car and it's going to be great. So they just built roads for everything and didn't think about railroads. And so now that's left cities, like Dallas and Phoenix in very, very tough positions to get away from cars.
So to get from one city to the next in America, you pretty much have to take a highway. I suppose you can also take an airplane. Where are we on building high-speed rail to connect big cities across the country to one another?
We are basically where we were 40 years ago. Huh. Almost nothing has changed. We made almost no progress. One transit expert I talked to named Yona Freemark, who's a PhD student at MIT, he kind of refers to this as the lost generation of U.S. railroad building, especially with respect to high-speed rail. High-speed rail wasn't really a thing before the 1960s and 1970s. Japan was the first in, I think it was the 1960s, and then Europe started to build their first high-speed rails in the 70s. So there's, you know, this was the era where the U.S. was an absolute, was, you know, a dominant global force, like technologically. There was no reason for the U.S. to not be right up there with these other countries in building this new and nascent technology. But like I said, we were so convinced that cars were the solution to everything that we just weren't interested in building these railroad systems. And for the most part, that continues to be true today. I mean, obviously, the California high-speed rail project has received a lot of press, almost entirely negative, for what a disaster that project has been for various reasons. But it's the only one that's really trying. In the Northeast Corridor, where Amtrak runs its extremely profitable rail service between Washington, D.C. and Boston, there's a grand total of 34 miles of track that counts as high speed. And it's only technically high speed in that it's over 130 miles per hour, just a little bit, while other countries run rail at 180 miles per hour. So we're really, really far behind.
Aaron W. Gordon is with us. He's a senior writer for Motherboard. His article, Why the U.S. Sucks at Building Public Transit, is available at vice.com. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist Aaron W. Gordon, who is a senior writer for Motherboard and has a piece on Vice called Why the U.S. Sucks at Building Public Transit. Aaron, I want to go back to something you touched on earlier, which is that some people argue that spending a lot of money on public transit, bus systems, light rail, high-speed rail, amounts to subsidizing transit for some people. Why don't we see similar obstacles to funding new roads or highway maintenance, which subsidize the travel of all of us who own cars?
Another great question with a very complicated answer, as with most questions related to the subject. I think on a fundamental level, there are probably two things happening here. One is that there's a widespread perception, especially outside of these northeastern cities where public transit usage is higher in the rest of the country, that everyone drives, nobody takes public transit. You know, there's kind of like this, I think that's a generally accepted rule of thumb when talking about the subject. And so that automatically makes it very hard to talk about subsidizing a service that is perceived as something that nobody uses. And then I think the second layer is that if you do drill down and you talk about who uses public transit in most areas of the country, it tends to be disadvantaged populations. It tends to be minorities, tends to be lower income people, and it tends to be women, interestingly enough. And so then you get into a debate that is, or you get into a subject that's not about public transit at all. It's about timeless kind of questions in this country about who the government should be serving and for what purposes. And historically, and even today, we see that a lot of times the government is less interested in providing services for the people who need it most, and more interested in providing services or using the federal largesse to support the lifestyles of the middle and upper middle classes instead. And so I think in that sense, what we've seen with the transit landscape historically fits very neatly with what we perceive government services should be.
So to make sure we're being fair here, how does the cost of road construction and maintenance compare with the cost of rail line construction?
Okay, I'm going to try and think how to summarize this as neatly as possible. It's very complicated. I actually struggled for weeks to find a number, like a way to really summarize how much, you know, rail construction and maintenance costs. And the short answer is there is no short answer. But that being said, road construction when, at first is cheaper on a per mile basis than rail. And so naturally that makes it appear cheaper. But this is, I think, another one of those fallacies that we have when it comes to building transportation structure, because roads have a lower, they fundamentally have a lower throughput. They serve fewer people on a per hour basis than transit does. So if you work out, and they cost more to maintain in the long run than rail structures do. And so if you chart it out over a decades long, life cycle cost analysis on a per rider or per user basis, there's a good argument to be made. I'm not going to say it's definitely this way, because again, it depends on the math in your specific city and what type of rail transit you're talking about and all these other kind of vagaries we don't need to get into here. But there's a good argument to be made that it's actually cheaper in the long run to build rail structures that people will actually use than it is to kind of get stuck in this endless cycle of road building and road maintenance and lane expansions and highway expansions and all that stuff.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. Our number is 800-933-5372. Jean is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Chris. Thank you. You guys just touched on a couple of points. One is, when you look at the social dynamics or the socioeconomic dynamics around mass transit, one of the things I've heard is, to the point the speaker was making earlier, is that a lot of cities and regions choose not to offer dynamic mass transit to keep that, to prohibit the reverse commute, i.e. we don't want individuals coming from those lower socioeconomic areas into the suburbs, because this would increase their socioeconomic status. So can the speaker expand, can the host expand, I'm sorry, the guest expand on that? Because I feel like, particularly within Dallas, with the city as a major metropolitan city, we don't really have a dynamic mass transit system, and we should.
Thanks.
And I'll take my response off the air.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Jean.
Yeah, I'm so glad Jean brought that point up. That's really important. Another kind of historical element that still lingers today. We actually saw this a lot in the 60s and 70s, when this was a very brief time when the federal government was extremely interested in funding big transportation systems. And cities held referenda on whether they should have this. And basically, it wasn't a cost question, because the federal government was willing to subsidize most of the cost. And a lot of cities, or at least counties within cities, said, no, we don't want these mass transit systems, for exactly the reason Jean said. And it wasn't couched in any kind of euphemisms. They explicitly said, we don't want Black people from the city to be able to come out to the suburbs, which are white.
Wow.
It was very explicit. The most probably obvious example of this was in Atlanta, where three counties surrounding Atlanta voted not to join the MARTA system, which MARTA does exist, but it's about half the size of the original proposal, because these counties said, we don't want Black people from the city center to be able to come out into the suburbs. And Detroit also voted against a large mass transit system around this time for similar reasons. Seattle had a very contentious referendum around this time as well, that was largely held as a referendum on race. The first one was unsuccessful. Then a second one that was much more limited in terms of the system's size did end up passing a few years later, because they basically took the parts of the suburbs that were most hostile to the proposal on racial grounds out of the system. And so they no longer had to vote as part of it. And this was repeated around the country. This is very common, and you will still see it today, although it's not as explicit in God, I'm totally blanking on the name. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there.
It's okay. Well, I have another question. Is there evidence that
Sure.
poor public transit hurts cities economically in the long run?
I think yes. The short answer is yes, because it creates an artificial cap on how convenient life can be in that city, basically. And that's something Nashville, Tennessee, I think, is dealing with right now. That was actually what I blanked about. I couldn't remember the name Nashville. But Nashville, 2 years ago, I think it was, in 2017, held a big referendum on whether they should create this gigantic bus system, what's called bus rapid transit, which is kind of like a combination of light rail and buses. And they voted against it. And it was, again, a very contentious vote based on these kind of racial tropes about, we don't want them to be able to come out here type of argument. Mm. And the reason why Nashville was considering such a very aggressive bus network expansion is because their traffic has gotten exponentially worse in the last 10 to 15 years as the city has really grown. And something is going to have to give. Either the city can't keep growing at its current rate where people can, you know, have reasonable commutes and pay reasonable rents, or it can build a convenient transit system that people can use to get downtown in a fast and speedy way and open up new areas of the city's development. You know, there have been all kinds of studies about how much New York City subway is really worth to the city in terms of, you know, how many more people can live here, how much the tax base is grown by it because so many more people can live in the area. And they tend to be on the orders of billions of dollars a year. You know, the assets are trillions of dollars over the course of tens of years. So there are many different ways to slice it. But the short answer is, yes, transit systems are economically beneficial to cities, even when you factor in the exorbitant cost of building and maintaining and running them.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. We have Michael on the line in Denton, Texas. Hi, Michael.
Yes. Hello. I think most of what your guest is saying is true, but I just wanted to point out that the DART system in Dallas County really is an excellent system, and it connects with the light rail in Tarrant and Denton counties. And, you know, they keep building new lines, they keep building new systems, and it's packed with commuters. It's rush hour every day, and it keeps expanding, and it's a great system. I use it every day. You have mixed-use developments like Mockingbird Station with housing and shopping, and so I think it's just a great system, and I just wanted to express that.
Thanks very much for calling. Yeah, there are people definitely who love their public transit, Aaron.
There are, and that's great, and I'm glad to hear it works for some people. You know, I think when I talk kind of broadly about public transit policy in the U.S., I obviously miss a lot of nuance. And, you know, I think the system, I think DART has something like 35 million riders a year, if I'm not mistaken. It's somewhere in that ballpark. And so obviously people use it. You know, it works for some people, and that's great. I think the larger point I'm trying to make is that it's not transformative to the city, you know, and you look at the highways, they're still just as congested as ever. It didn't, you know, the construction of the system didn't result in lots of people giving up their cars because they no longer need them. And so I think that's the kind of general failure to which I'm addressing, not that it, you know, is literally never useful to anyone in any context.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Another problem that you say a lot of metro areas have is that transit planning is done on like a very municipal scale rather than always being looked at first as a regional issue. Why does that matter so much?
Well, it matters because every transit system, no matter what kind of transit you're talking about, whether it's, you know, a regional rail system, a subway, or even just down to like the humble bike lane, is fundamentally a network. It's people from different places looking to navigate a city, to get around a city. And so the more you zoom in to get approval on a, you know, on a neighborhood by neighborhood level, the more veto points you create. And if the people choose to exercise their veto power on these points, then you don't end up with a network. Then you end up with sporadic segments, or the network gets redirected away from where it makes the most sense to be useful to the most people and towards where it can be built. And I think one of the problems we've seen in especially some newer U.S. cities, I think Dallas counts as one of them, is they end up building these systems along freeways because these are rights of way that the government already owns. And so there is no veto necessary. You know, you don't have to deal with a neighborhood that doesn't want a light rail running in the median of their street, for example. And there, you know, there's obviously benefits there, but the downside is nobody begins or ends their journey at a freeway. And so that fundamentally limits the usefulness of these systems. And I think that's just one example of how this kind of regional, removing the planning from a regional level and bringing it down to more of a local level has negative ramifications on how useful that transit network will actually be.
All right. Let's speak this time with Damien in Irving, Texas. Hi, Damien.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I just wanted to ask, I think I heard one time that the federal government had a lot to do in creating the ghettos around the cities in the United States because of the way they built the highways around the cities. They had no entrance ramp or exit ramp into the where the like poor people live, and they enhanced the ghetto. Is that true?
Thanks for calling.
Kind of. I mean, so there were definitely ghettos before highways. There were definitely disadvantaged areas before highways. And I'm going to try and summarize the history of urban renewal in a few minutes, which will not work, but I'll do my best. So basically, in the mid-50s, or a little before, the U.S. government, the federal government, took a very big interest in what it called the urban problem. Basically, the idea that cities were becoming the phenomenon of white flight was happening. Middle class white Americans were moving to suburbs, which were often explicitly whites only. Non-whites could not move there by covenant. And so naturally that meant minorities still remained in the cities. And so urban renewal was an effort to try and reduce what they called the slum problem. And part of urban renewal occurred at the same time as the highway building. And the two programs often got kind of merged in the same areas and with the same intents. And so you ended up with a lot of quote unquote slums getting destroyed to make way for highways. And as the caller pointed out, these highways were not designed for the benefit of the people living in the cities. They were designed for the benefit of the people who had moved outside of the cities and wanted a reliable way to get to their jobs in the city center. And little regard was made for the minorities who still lived within the city. So I think it's not quite right to say that the federal government created the slums, but it is right to say, at least not through that explicit policy, but it is right to say that they exacerbated the problem by dividing these neighborhoods with highways that made them even worse places to live than they had been before.
Aaron W. Gordon is senior writer for Motherboard. You can read his article, Why the U.S. Sucks at Building Public Transit, at the website Vice. Aaron, thank you so much for making time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter, and we hope that you'll subscribe to our podcast wherever you get podcasts. You could do a search for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.